You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Brad Loncar, and my co-hosts today are Tim Oppler, Brian Scorney, Luba Greenwood. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. And we'll get into all of this more specifically, but man, we have an abundance of good news in biotech for a change. I'm sure everybody saw yesterday, we had a very successful IPO, so that's CG Oncology. That's an oncolytic virus company that has a bladder cancer study in late stage. They raised $380 million, and amazingly, the stock closed up 96%. It closed at like almost $40 a share. And so when you start to see that, you know, everybody takes notice. And today we actually have a smaller IPO happening, but still pretty significant. So it's Aerovent, which has an EGFR TKI that was developed in China, and they've raised $175 million, and that's upsized from, I think, like $130 million that they were planning on originally raising. But first, we're going to go to a deal. So Sanofi is buying Inhibrx, actually an asset from Inhibrx. This is their treatment for alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. It's a big deal. It's $1.7 billion. And one of the things that I think is interesting about it is it's what I call a Biohaven deal, which is Inhibrx is selling off this asset, but the Inhibrx team is staying on and developing the rest of their pipeline. So I'll kick it over to Luba to tell us more about this deal and what you think of it.
Yeah, thanks so much. I completely agree. Great deal, exciting structure. And as we know, Sanofi has been looking to diversify its pipeline, and now it's growing more in the rare disease space. So again, this is earlier announcement just this week that through their subsidiary Aventis, they are going to buy these rare disease assets from Inhibrx. And specifically, as you mentioned, it's relating to NBTX-101 asset, which is in the AAT augmentation therapy, which is right now in registrational trial for treatment of patients with AATD. So in other words, it's a genetic disorder, pretty serious, rare, that increases risk for developing liver and lung cancer. The initial readout will be in the end of the year, and specifically that is focused on the patients with lung disease. So we'll be keeping an eye out on that. All the other assets, as you mentioned, will be spun out into a newly publicly traded company. It will be called Inhibrx Biosciences. The current team is staying on. The company is funded. Sanofi has put in $200 million, which is part of that $2.2 billion deal. They put $200 million in cash. In return, Sanofi will get 8% interest in the company, and the current management and shareholders of Inhibrx will retain the rest of 92%. And this reflects, again, the Sanofi strategy to become a power player in biopharma. They did spin out their consumer business, and we've all been watching what are they going to be focusing on. Pretty weak in oncology, very strong, about a quarter of their sales have been coming from Dupixent, so it's good to see that they're in a race to grow their R&D pipeline. And specifically, which is one of the things they've been saying about this asset acquisition, is they're looking to go into best-in-class medicine. The acquisition will be completed in Q2. They're not the only ones that are in this market. There are other players in the AATD market, which is Takeda and Grifols. And the market is expected to grow to about $4 billion. And there are also a few companies that are going after the space and have early candidates not yet on the market, and there are Vertex and Wave. So looking forward to see what happens, and a great play by Sanofi.
Luba and Tim and Brian also, if you'd like to comment, what do you think of this this deal structure of, like, you know, Inhibrix living on to develop more things. I'm a big fan of it because, you know, as we know, like, a lot of times companies get acquired for their late stage or commercial stage mm-hmm. asset, and the R&D expenses for everything else is like a drag on the pharma earnings. And sometimes things like that get scuttled. So it seems like a win-win-win for the acquirer, for the company that's acquired, and for patients, because the larger company gets the late stage asset and the innovation mm-hmm. keeps churning out new things. I think it's a great thing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. You're absolutely right. They also paid off debt, to your point. It's helping them now really move forward. And they're also focusing now on oncology, which is, again, not something that Sanofi is the strength of Sanofi, not something that they're focusing on. And it is a win-win. And also because a lot of the times what we've seen before, especially in the boom times, pharma companies would buy that one asset and then park the remaining assets in development, especially if they're in an area like here in oncology where they may not be of interest currently. And when they park it, they really stop development and they are they're just sitting there and living out their patent. And it's also pretty hard for many firms, as we all know, to in-license some of those assets. And so this is fantastic and truly a value creation move by both sides.
I agree. I think it's a very nice structure. And what's impressive, both Biohaven and Inhibrix, is this is not an easy structure to do. And so, you know, we don't talk a lot about the lawyers, but the lawyers and the structuring people behind these deals, you know, deserve a tip of the hat for figuring out how to actually get this kind of sales spin structure to work.
Yeah, I think, you know, Brad, I think like everything, it's really dependent on the management team that that the market backs after the acquisition and spin out and the assets involved, right? I mean, I think the world of Lab and Biohaven and what they have in development. But you're right. I mean, it that has to be the consideration because there's plenty of teams that have triggered an acquisition and then went on to do something else and have failed with the assets, right? So I think it's very much a case by case basis. But you know, when you have a great development team who has an eye for good assets, yeah, I mean, it certainly falls in the same theme as you know, anything, whether you back them in a subsequent IPO or you back them you know, a smart group of investors in a SPAC. You know, it's a different structure, which I think can work very, very well in some cases.
Yeah, it's interesting you said about the lawyers. I usually don't look up who are the lawyers on deals. I did look that one up because I was myself very curious who advised them on this deal. So, I mean, nobody that's, you know, your usual, the Paul Weiss and Weil Gotshal. So they really did a great job. But I agree. That was of interest to me.
All right. Well, with IPOs coming back, that's not the only corner of financing that's heating up. And one area that we've seen a lot of activity lately is private placements, so PIPEs. Tim, this is something that you and I talked a lot about during our discussion at the New York Stock Exchange on Monday. You know, you kind of said how investors are actually approaching companies that maybe weren't even looking for money in the first place. I think that goes to show how strong the market is right now. I want to start with one, though, that's a little bit of a touchy subject for investors. Some people are for this and some people are against this. So Kura Oncology has some key data coming up for their menin inhibitor next week. And this week they announced $150 million private placement. It was at like a 30% premium to the closing price of their stock. And it's one of these deals, correct me if I'm wrong, where the investors, I think, got a look at like blinded data. And so the controversy here, of course, is that, you know, the stock market should be a level playing field for all investors. And, you know, when you're raising money right before key data, and some investors have at least seen something that others haven't, like is that fair? And is that like a great way of, you know, raising money that benefits our whole sector? Can you talk a little bit more about this deal specifically, and let me know if I have all those details right, and just kind of what you think about this whole idea of doing these pipes based off of looking at blinded data ahead of key data events?
Yeah, I mean, Brad, it's a great point, and it's a real debate. But before I hit kind of your question on, is this the right thing for the market? Maybe if you don't mind, I'd like to give kind of just a big picture description of what's going on right now. So, you know, we had this pandemic. We had just giant money flowing into our sector, sort of unprecedented. So maybe as an example, July of 2020, we saw $18 billion of follow-on deals done. Well, if you back up in history, by May of 22, all that money was flowing the other way. And in that month, we saw less than $1 billion in follow-on deals done. So the air just went completely out of the balloon. And last year was a pretty rough year. And so we got into this world where specialist investors would do kind of buy appointment pipes and all of this stuff that we're talking about. And so the average sort of monthly follow-on volume for biotech companies was sort of $2 to $2.5 billion throughout most of late 2022 and all of 2023. All of a sudden, the macro picture has changed. So for example, this week, we saw a PCE inflation data for December, and those data look really good. So like we're at, you know, close to the Fed's target of 2% inflation. The S&P is up actually really big. For whatever reason, generalist money is yet to flow into our sector. Although I do think, you know, how you were talking about like CG Oncology, the stock popping, the thing was upsized a couple times. I mean, that feels like there's a lot of speculative interest in that stock. It is a very good company, to be clear. So this month, you know, we're at the end of the month today. This month, we're going to see $4 billion, actually a little more, in follow-on equity volume. And that's in the backdrop of this improving macro picture. And so, you know, all of a sudden, this is our biggest month for follow-on since the middle of 2022. The last really big month was August of 2022. Usually when you have a big month, there's like one company out there, like Argenx will go out and do like a $750 million follow-on. The largest deal this month was nowhere close to that. I think it was like $350 million. So there's been a ton of issuance activity. I spoke to several investors yesterday who said they're actually having trouble getting through all of the inbounds to do these pipes and to do the follow-on. So normally investors are like, please send us these pipes because they're kind of attractive, as you hinted. And so right now we just have this massive traffic jam of issuance activity that has been created by the changed macro picture. So yeah, so Kura, as an example, a very kind of interesting deal. They raised money at a premium to their pre-data level, at least. And they went out and they raised $150 million. And that money came largely from existing investors. So, you know, you could argue that those guys must have had a peek at some blinded data, and that doesn't feel right. I'm normally the one that would say, you know, I'm kind of a free market guy. So like, well, you know, it's a free market. So just to be clear, SEC rules allow this. It's perfectly legal to not disclose a piece of confidential information, tie up an investor with a CDA, restrict that investor and sell them stock based on confidential information. In this case, the stock of Kura just shot up massively after this deal because essentially the deal itself sort of tipped that there is positive data coming, or very likely positive data coming. So the question is this fair? Is it a level playing field? And I would just make the simple comment that there is nothing about our securities rules that promises a level playing field in the offering of securities. Brad, if you owned a company, you can sell stock to me at any price you and I can agree to, and that's between us. So that's just the rules in this country. Other countries have very different structures. So like in Sweden, you have to start every offering with a rights offering. for example, to your existing shareholders, which is kind of in a way what this was. Stock right in front of data like this, right? To me, it doesn't feel quite right, but it's perfectly legal.
Yeah, I guess the question is, obviously I'm not a lawyer, but the thing I think about is Reg FD. And if you have material information, you have a responsibility to, you know, to disseminate it to everybody. And so the question here is, like, is blinded data, like, it seems to me that that's like kind of as close as you could get to material information. Like, it's kind of a gray area, right?
Yeah, I mean, that one's out of my pay grade. I won't opine because I don't know. I know Luba, I think you're a lawyer. Maybe she would have a view.
Yes, I
threw her a hot potato. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yes. And yeah, so I think it's, I would say it depends as a lawyer on how you define material information. But I agree that here, this is completely within the scope of the SEC rules. I'm also a free market person. So I completely understand the question and why one would think that perhaps this is a material information that is given to one party and advantages that one party. But it's, if you actually look at specifics, this is, all done properly. I could be wrong though.
I mean, I'll make a comment, which is, this looks like a sweetheart deal, right? You know,
right.
Why does EcoR1 and Deerfield get to show up to this party and I don't? And so this is not a common approach, but it is also not unprecedented. So, for example, some of you may remember that Sierra Oncology did this ahead of their data back in 2021, I believe. They were bought in 2022. And those investors, ex post, didn't underpay for their stock. So this is a very dangerous game for the investor. They think they're getting a great deal, but it may not be case that they are. So it's kind of a high risk move for the investor.
Yeah, we have, yeah, and that's not the only example. We have seen a couple where the stock has crashed. Like, another one I remember for sure was Immunocore had really key data at ESMO one year, and they did this as well. And the stock, I mean, it's since recovered and, you know, they're doing great. But like when the data was released at ESMO, it crashed pretty hard and those people got burned. So I guess reading the blinded tea leaves isn't always an easy thing.
So I agree. And by the way, this was relatively uncommon, but speaking with investors, this is something we'll see more and more of. So I would, if I were currently a company and looking into this type of financing, I would want to learn more.
Well, let me ask one last question, though, and then we'll move on. We have a pretty busy slate of topics. Is what's in it for the company? Is the comp, because like in a traditional scenario, you'd release your data, you know, fingers crossed that the data is great, and then you do a huge, you know, public follow-on offering based off of, you know, all of the your stock price going up and all of that. So is the benefit here basically Cura taking some risk off the table that even though they've seen the blinded data too, that, you know, maybe the study isn't so positive and they can raise before it? Is that the main idea here?
Yeah, that's right. So Cura has de-risked this data readout and, you know, who knows, they might know a thing or two that the investors had a chance to see and didn't really appreciate. That could be of a negative nature. So they have secured their financing, as they said in their press release, up to 2027, which is some level what every CFO needs to do. So it's a free market. We have a willing issuer and we have willing buyers. And right. They came together. This is not a normal way deal.
Yeah. And you secured a long, more likely a raise in the more of a longer term success potentially
if the data turns out good.
Right. And then, but I guess lastly, you'd say if you're any company, you don't want to burn, you know, Deerfield and Echo R1 and like all of those like investors that you need down the road. So I guess there's also like the unspoken idea that you would think they wouldn't be doing this if they didn't have a, you know, high expectation that, you know, everybody will be happy at the end of the day. All right. Well, Tim, I actually see like three other pipes on the list: Outlook, Deanthesis, and Oric. Is there anything that you'd like to mention about those?
Nothing about those specific companies, other than to say each one is really cool company. Each one has its own story, and this month there must have been, you know, 25 significant financing. So it's like official biotech financing month. And very cool to see the market reopen after such a tough period.
Great. All right, so let's go to some more news of the day. And Luba, I'll kick it over to you on the Gilead Trodelvy failure. So that was announced first thing Monday. This was a lung cancer indication, and Gilead was down 10%, which is like over $10 billion for them. I mean, that's a major news event. What's your take?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I know I like to cover the happy stuff, but I agree. It's also an ADC, as we know that this is really hot and closely followed by many. So yeah, I mean, their ADC failed to hit an endpoint, which for them was extension of survival in phase 3, specifically for lung cancer for previously treated metastatic non-small lung cancer patients. Just as a reminder, Gilead has gotten access to this drug, to Trodelvy, by acquiring in 2020 a company called Immunomedics. They acquired that for $21 billion. The company pretty quickly came out saying that they still have confidence, saying that there's still some efficacy signals from its phase 2 trial, which they did in combination with Keytruda. However, as you mentioned, Brad, the street doesn't really buy that, and their stock did lose 10% of its value, which is huge. It is a big setback for Gilead. They have tried to really focus on oncology, kind of get away from their earlier days and claim to fame. And they knew that Trodelvy, it has worked in metastatic breast cancer. It was approved just recently in February 2023. For breast cancer, it showed 30% reduction in disease progression, but it's not enough for them. It is breast cancer, especially that subpopulation, is a fairly limited market because of enormous competition from others, including Daiichi and AstraZeneca, who have a rival ADC drug called Enhertu. And this also failure, Gilead wanted to get into a bigger market with this lung cancer. So it's a major setback for the company. Another thing I would just note briefly is that, as I mentioned, investors in pharma and even oncologists, they've all been excited about ADCs. I can tell you every time I talk to anybody in oncology or really any investment in ADC technologies from very early to late stage. So everyone was watching this closely and is quite disappointed. But I wouldn't say it's too disappointing. I mean, still ADC space is hot. I personally think, and many KOLs I talk to think, it's a promising space. And Roche did just do a $1 billion deal with Metalink Therapeutics to develop ADC in oncology. So overall positive potentially for ADC, quite bad for Gilead.
Brian, I think you cover Gilead, right?
You know,
they have this plan. I interviewed Dan O'Day in April, and you know, they always talk about how by 2030 they want to be a top 10 oncology company, and to have oncology be like a third of their revenues by then. As everyone knows, it's mostly HIV right now. I think it's like 3/4 of earnings. You know, Kite has been pretty successful, but what's your take on this, and what does it mean for Gilead to be like the leader in oncology that they want to become?
Yeah, so you know, I mean, I think there's kind of like a nuanced story. I mean, I think everyone woke up and saw the 10% down move and was like, oh my God, it's such a big move for Gilead. But I mean, the stock was back here, you know, 4 weeks ago. So it had a big run up. Part of that is just kind of sector sentiment on large caps. A lot of large caps have run up in recent days. But I think on Trodelvy specifically, the nuance here is, you know, they're in this sort of heated competition with AstraZeneca's TROP2 antibody Dato-DXd. And Astra had data in the fall that wasn't that great in lung cancer. I think a little softer than people were expecting. But I think what's been really notable about Dato-DXd, that people started thinking, oh, you know, maybe Trodelvy has a real shot to be sort of the leader in lung cancer, was you really see these safety events that are occurring with Dato-DXd, interstitial lung disease. And, you know, as you can imagine, if you have a lung cancer patient and the drug that induces interstitial lung disease, all else being equal, you don't want that, right? So I think the view was, as we've seen data emerge from both Trodelvy and Dato-DXd over the last year or so, these drugs look pretty comparable. So I think the feeling was, if they could sort of get by with modest efficacy in lung cancer in this study, that the absence of these safety events would really drive it to be the preferred TROP2 antibody compared to Dato-DXd. I think the problem here is, Dato-DXd itself kind of just maybe hit the threshold of what's approvable. They had a co-primary endpoint and they hit in PFS. Here, the endpoint was OS and they missed, and they didn't really provide an OS number. They never provided a PFS number. So I think, what you're really seeing here is all that positive sentiment that was shifting to Trodelvy and lung cancer really falling off, as the expectation that either of these drugs are going to do much in lung cancer. We actually titled in our note, we said docetaxel is a hell of a drug, because, both of these studies are going against docetaxel, like a 50-year-old chemotherapy in second-line lung cancer, and haven't really meaningfully beat that. So it's hard to see, you know, this very expensive series of drugs that are, you know, really not beating basically a free chemotherapy in these studies kind of being moved into sort of a frontline high use setting. So that's what I think you're really seeing here in the aftermath.
And on Gilead, you know, their oncology ambitions, like, what does this mean for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to take it with complete faith that oncology is going to continue to grow. I mean, look, Trodelvy is approved. It's seeing growth. It's getting utilization. It's approved breast cancer indications. I know we're going to probably talk about this next, but the Kite story has really become a silver lining for Gilead. It was something that I wasn't a big fan of when it was done. It took a very long time to kind of build into a large market opportunity, but Yescarta is the market leader now, and it continues to grow. And I think that's really kind of the biggest area of growth opportunity and revenue opportunity for Gilead, to kind of expand on that. Trodelvy, we'll have to see. It obviously has activity across a range of different indications. Gilead's going to spend a lot of money trying to tease out those factors. And, there's some, I think one of the big selling points on Immunomedics, and this may be more characteristic for Yescarta than Trodelvy, but there's a bit of like sort of a evergreen nature to these assets, and that it's very unclear, given the manufacturing and the complexity of the drugs, what sort of biosimilar competition you have down the road. Is there really like a true LOE for any of these assets? So if you could, expand indications for Trodelvy over time, can you grow into a big product that sort of goes way beyond what a standard exclusivity is? I think that's sort of one of the potential bets here. But
it's not going to get you there by 2030. I mean, that's the problem. Dan O'Day came from, Genentech and Roche, that had a deep pipeline, very deep at both PRED, GRED, in oncology, and a number of ongoing acquisitions in the space just to support if there are failures. And I haven't seen that. I haven't followed Gilead as closely as you have. So is there any insight into that? I mean, are they... What do you think? Should they do some more acquisitions, beef up internal R&D?
So I think there's a lot of skepticism on the buy side in particular over the oncology strategy. Hasn't been that successful so far. They've spent a lot of money trying to get there. And I think when you look at like the Gilead multiple compared to their peers, they're not given anywhere near the growth projections that, like, a Vertex is or Regeneron is. despite, you know, in every way, shape, or form, a much higher profit margin and profitability over HIV. So there is a lot of concern that, you know, these oncology assets that maybe, you know, their acquisitions are NPV neutral or even NPV negative. I think magrolimab and the CD47 is getting written down. You know, they're not writing down anything on Immunomedics today, but I think the indication is that maybe coming to some extent soon. So, you know, I mean, they have to, I think, if they really want to be bigger in oncology, I think they're going to have to do it through M&A. But there's a ton of skepticism that they have demonstrated that capability through the last few deals that they've done.
Agreed.
All right. One other small incremental data announcement from this week that I'll mention because it's a closely watched company. So Cytokinetics, you know, everyone remembers the Sequoia phase 3 of aficamten, the cardiac myosin inhibitor. They had some data at a medical meeting in the UK yesterday. This was from an open label study called FOREST-HCM. And basically they looked at cardiac magnetic resonance imaging. And what they're seeing is actual like improvement in like the structure of the heart. So they saw like, you know, benefits in left ventricular mass index, you know, maximum left ventricular septal wall thickness, left atrial volume and things like that. So we're not only seeing like, you know, the endpoints like, you know, peak oxygen levels that we're seeing in like those phase 3 trials, we're actually seeing like, you know, change in the structure of the heart for the better. And this is another company that, you know, there's been wild speculation about, you know, possible M&A. There were Wall Street Journal stories about potentially Novartis looking at them during JPM, but then that cooled off. And, you know, we'll have to see how everything goes here. But Brian, you mentioned it. I'll kick it back to you on cell therapy. So, you know, last fall, the FDA put out the note to the physician community about malignancies that they're seeing in the CAR T space. And now we saw basically with one exception, class-wide black boxes, you know, kind of formalizing all of this. Tell us more about that and like what it potentially means.
Yeah, right. So, you know, Brett, I think you and I have had like almost decade-long dialogue on CAR T. So it's been a pretty big theme over the years. And, you know, as you know, I've kind of been like more lukewarm probably than a lot of people on these. But look, they're an amazing technology for some diseases and lines of therapy. You know, really miracle in sort of late line, ALL, LBCL, myeloma. But they're also really powerful modalities and the kind of thing are not certainly not for everyone. So, you know, this black box warnings is not really a surprise. I mean, the FDA kind of communicated that they were following these cases back in November, these T-cell malignancy cases. Seems to be an extremely low rate. You know, there's a lot of questions about, you know, whether or not there's true established causality when that November warning came out. The FDA seems to be pretty confident that there is a causal role here. There's a lot of attention on Peter Marks's comments about Sarepta over JP Morgan week. But one of the things that I thought was also noticeable was he really kind of confirmed that they sort of have internal evidence of a causal role here. To start, you know, I'd say for currently approved and commercially successful indications, this is really a nothing burger. I mean, there's so much data on the benefits in these patients with like late line disease, be it, you know, B cell malignancy or myeloma. I don't get any sense that these low rates are a cause of concern at all. You just have so much of a profoundly positive risk reward for these patients. You know, the label isn't going to impact anything. You know, look all the way into frontline myeloma. We know there's evidence of secondary malignancies with Revlimid, but there's never been enough to sort of change what has been at the end of the day a highly favorable risk reward for the patient. I think you sort of have this here. I think as you get into like lower grade tumors, maybe this becomes more of an issue. You know, like as an example, I know there was a smoldering myeloma study presented at ASH with BCMA CART. And I guess like it's a study, so it's like it's commercial there, but it seems almost ludicrous to test BCMA CAR T in an indication that really has been kind of watch and wait and a non-interventional indication. So I think it makes it, you know, incrementally harder to move into easier indications, you know, whether it be something like CLL. You know, and autoimmune disease, I think, is one of the big themes that people are a little worried about with these. Certainly, if you can provide a durable cure for something like lupus, some patients are going to elect to try this despite the risks. But it really becomes a much different calculation. So I think, you know, with everything in drug development, you got to look at like the disease and the patient and, you know, what that true risk is of anything. You know, any drug is going to have some safety risk associated with it. And it's just about figuring out the proper therapeutic index for a group of patients here. But, you know, I would say at the outset, like it really shouldn't impact any of these commercial drugs at all.
And I mean, you kind of mentioned it, like, what does this mean for like all of the excitement about autoimmune right now? I mean, we're having IPOs, like, you know, you're seeing every company make an autoimmune announcement, you know, CRISPR Therapeutics, like literally all of them. Are we seeing same? Are we seeing like, you know, one thing I think that people don't follow this closely might be surprised to learn is that the CAR Ts that are being used in autoimmune, at least initially, in many cases, are the exact same product. Like it's just like the same CD19 that companies are using in cancer, they're using for autoimmune. Now, there are companies that are making tweaks and improvements specifically, you know, for autoimmune diseases and to like, you know, lower the cytokine response and everything. But in many cases, it's the same product. So like, what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think again, it goes back to it's very early days. We don't know what the rate is, and you know, I sort of alluded to this. You know, for someone who has like severe lupus nephritis, and you know, a myriad of associated issues with sort of their broader SLE, you know, if this is like a 1 in 10,000 risk, they may elect to take it, right? But I think if you kind of think of like a broad SLE opportunity, where you know, patients may have you know, much more modest clinical symptomology, and it waxes and wanes, right? You know, I would think that patient isn't going to look for something even with a 1 in 10,000 risk of a T cell malignancy occurring, right? So again, it's all about therapeutic index, and if you can cure a patient who has a severe disease that is oftentimes fatal, then versus a 1 in 10,000 risk, like you'll take it. So I think we're kind of in early innings. I would certainly be more cautious about throwing in, you know, $10 billion in sales and sort of a more modest B cell mediated disease for these. But look, I mean, I think we'll have to look over time to see, you know, what the true incident rate is and how successful these CAR Ts can be for other, you know, autoimmune B cell diseases that are not malignant. But yeah, I mean, I would certainly have an element of additional caution over that.
Okay. Yeah, I just very briefly to add on that, I couldn't agree more. And I think one thing that is, and just to back up, right? I mean, why are we in this? Why are we seeing this, Brad? As you mentioned, some people may not realize that it's the almost identical drug and delivered in the same way and has the same safety concerns as in oncology. And the reason for that is because the good news is why it came, a lot of the knowledge came from oncology is because there is a lot of research in the oncology space, a lot of money spent, both the federally funded and VC funded. So we have a much better understanding and a lot of that learning has come from oncology. So that's the positive. The negative is some of the reasons why people are rushing now to take those applications from oncology and put them into autoimmune disease. Is driven by a market and some market forces. And of course, the potential acquirers and the biopharma is looking at this and saying, wow, look at this. We have some sort of a novel pathway and the autoimmune disease space is increasing. We want to beef up our immunology, autoimmune pipelines because that's where a lot of the money is. And we've seen that, of course, with AbbVie being one of the best-selling drugs of all time, about $26 billion a year. But I think what they're overlooking, to Brian's point, is that the applicable patient population for many of these drugs is for very, very sick patients. And the biggest market opportunity is for moderate disease autoimmune patients. So it's just something to think about.
Thank you. Brian, speaking of black boxes, this one's a little unusual. Amgen got one for Prolia, a drug that's been on the market for, you know, over a decade now. And so this was for hypocalcemia risk in CKD patients. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I mean, again, there's another situation where the FDA has kind of signaled it well in advance. You know, they had been pretty clear that they're looking into cases of severe hypocalcemia in patients with advanced CKD. So not a surprise that there's a black box here. And in fact, you know, I would say this is even more, probably more of a nothing burger than the CAR T T-cell malignancy risk. You know, the risks of lower calcium has been well understood with denosumab for over at least a decade, almost its entire commercial life. And in large part, right, like you can offset these risks with supplements. I think on label, they recommend using calcium and vitamin D, which are essentially free ways to mitigate this. You know, in patients on dialysis, is there going to be an incremental factor of reduced use here? Maybe, but again, like talking to docs, I think they're really used to managing through this, and this is not something new or surprising that they're being informed of. It's sort of just a, you know, maybe a FDA liability offset. But again, as you kind of pointed out, even if I turned out to be wrong, Amgen is really facing biosimilar competition for denosumab in the next year or so. So I don't think it's a, you know, from an investor standpoint or an Amgen earnings standpoint, it actually matters. Ironically, I've actually heard a couple of people say the opposite, that maybe it's good for Amgen as it sort of adds this incremental concern over potential biosimilar denosumabs. Like, will docs be more conservative in terms of wanting to keep patients on the brand versus switch to something where, you know, theoretically you should be the same, but we all know these biologics are maybe not truly the exact same. So does it actually help offset loss of exclusivity? I can't imagine that it actually changes the trajectory of Prolia after LOE. So again, for investors, I don't think this is really much of a consideration.
All right. Well, let's switch over and talk about a couple of things that were in the news this week where it's like, how awesome is science? So I'm going to start with Tim. Tim, you know, for gene therapies, is for people who follow the space closely, know, like one of the first things they were tested in is like types of blindness. So think of like Spark Therapeutics and like the historic approval that it had many years ago. And we've always hoped that we would see the same thing for genetic causes of hearing loss. And Eli Lilly was in the news today or this week for a program that they have. And I know we've seen some very intriguing anecdotes of patients benefiting from gene therapies for hearing losses in China as well. Tell us a little bit more about the Lilly news.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this was actually the most interesting story of the week. So Eli Lilly, I mean, I don't think of Eli Lilly as like, you know, Sarepta, right? Eli Lilly reports that an 11-year-old boy that received a gene therapy from a company that they acquired called Acuos, this boy was born with profound hearing loss, experienced essentially complete restored hearing within 30 days of receiving a specialist AAV therapy. So, you know, that's like a big moment in history for that disease. It's obviously a big moment for the boy. And I think it's a big moment for Eli Lilly. Eli Lilly is saying to the world, you know, you think of us as obesity, oncology, Alzheimer's, we're a lot more than that. And that's something that they've emphasized again and again. I think it's important to note that this is very much a biotech success story. So if you go back in history, in November 2017, a professor and entrepreneur, Manny Simons, convinced somehow Ed Mathers from NEA and Kush Parmar from 5AM Ventures to give him $7.5 million to start this company, Acuos. They pretty soon went public, got a nice valuation, and then all of a sudden, as I was saying before, by mid-2022, the market had gone down. This stock was down 86% Lilly then intelligently stepped in and bought the company in late 22 for around $500 million. And well, now the rest is history. I mean, based on these data, it looks to me like they're going to have an approval. And, you know, this could be a very large drug. So hats off to Dr. Simons, hats off to the patients, hats off to the crazy VCs that put money into such a nutty venture, and absolutely hats off to Eli Lilly for carrying it through.
Yeah, and maybe we'll start to think of Lilly more in that way in the future. You know, they this last year they struck the Verve partnership, and for any of our listeners or who are in Boston or you know are really familiar with it, if you've ever walked across one of the bridges to the seaport, you've probably seen like the enormous genetic medicines facility that Lilly is building. I think it's technically Fort Point, but basically like the Seaport area, it's pretty darn cool. So looking forward to seeing more innovations from there. Luba, another thing that was in the news, you know, vaccines have been very controversial to say the least over the last few years, unfortunately. And a really important one is the HPV vaccine for young women. And it sounds like the country of Scotland did like a really large study, populational study, that just really showed how amazingly effective HPV vaccination is for cervical cancer. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, Brad, absolutely. I agree. This is exciting, very exciting news. So they rolled this HPV vaccine to girls aged about 12 to 13 back in 2008. So these women, so when we're thinking about the outcome of the study right now, these women are about in their early 30s and younger. As many know, HPV is most commonly is the cause of almost every single one of cervical cancer cases, and it's actually the fourth leading cause of cancer for women. And what they did in the study is they followed these women, and they found that there has been no cervical cancer, zero. Among these young, well, women now, women in their early 30s and younger, because they were vaccinated at age 12 to 13 and back in 2008. Of course, very exciting news. Of course, yes, they're still young. There's a lot more to do and follow, but this is overall significant news in the way that the study was done. And so one day, hopefully, we can eliminate cervical cancer altogether, with good screening, and this vaccine as well. So unprecedented study. We haven't seen that many, which has done really kind of real world evidence, and seeing real impact of this vaccine, where they monitored a whole cohort of women over such a long period of time and really found zero instances of cervical cancer. So just to give you a sense of how that compares to the US, in Scotland, HPV is a routine vaccine administered in school. So as a result, they have about 90% of young women get this vaccine. In the US, hopefully we can do better because they are not administered in school. And so far, on average, about it's been reported 60% of young women have been vaccinated with HPV vaccine. So hopefully the study will encourage more to get vaccinated.
And Tim, speaking of vaccines, there's like a surge in measles right now, and I think it's especially bad in Europe, right?
That's right. So last year we had 42,000 measles cases in Europe. And then last week we had this outbreak of measles in Birmingham in the UK. five kids died last week of measles. So, you know, if you kind of track diseases like, I don't know, measles or, you know, that sort of thing, think of like the Gates Foundation chasing down the last case of polio in some African country. Well, for some reason, you know, with all these anti-vaxxers, people in Europe have started to pull back on their MMR vaccine, which obviously includes measles. And, you know, now we have a lot of measles. And so the comments from Luba are right on. Getting vaccinations, especially for children, prioritized is a very high priority. And at the moment, the UK, which is a country I think of as in general, you know, very advanced in terms of its public health efforts, is paying the price for poor vaccination policy.
All right. Another thing I see on our list is that you know, we have the election year right now, of course, and I think it's a given that our industry is going to take it on the chin no matter what happens. But there does seem to be some good news happening out there in like the political world. So the House Ways and Means Committee approved a restoration of the R&D tax credit in a 40-3 bipartisan vote. So that's just the committee. So we still have to have a full House vote. But I'm wondering if any of our panelists would like to comment on just kind of all of that, you know, political stuff, IRA, and just, you know, trying to sway things back in a better direction.
I mean, I think it's a big step to get that R&D tax credit reinstated. It's sort of crazy that it wouldn't be. So hats off to the House for getting that done. You know, more broadly, pretty big week last week. So, you know, I think it kind of became fairly clear coming out of the New Hampshire primary that Trump is the likely Republican nominee. Obviously, Biden is almost certainly the Democratic nominee. And Brad, you're right, there's going to be a lot of pharma bashing coming up. You know, in the last Trump administration, there was a lot of anti-pharma talk, but, you know, sort of like the wall, you know, Trump talks but doesn't necessarily do. So his actual actions against the pharma industry weren't as bad. In contrast, I think at least I was very surprised by, you know, just how tough Biden's actually been from a policy perspective on the pharma industry. So it's going to be, it's not just the atmospherics during the election that we have to keep an eye on, but a very much, you know, it, and I'm not, you know, advocating Trump, but probably Trump would be a better choice for the pharma sector. We'll see. I'll make another comment, which is we talked about the rush of financings. A number of issuers I've spoken to have said, I would rather finance in January, February than wait around for, you know, this election rhetoric to hit up. So I think that's part of the explanation for this heavy financing wave we've seen this month.
One thing that I think is interesting from like a bipartisan standpoint, I interviewed Jeremy Levin at the New York Stock Exchange on Monday as well. And he was the chairman of BIO during the time that the IRA passed. And he said, like, I forget the exact number and statistic that he used, but he said when they polled both Republicans and Democrats on the IRA and like the Medicare negotiations and all of that, that there was almost unanimous support for the Medicare negotiation thing. And so he said, you know, the fact that the voting was totally partisan, like, don't be deceived by that. Like, we've got a lot of work to do to educate everybody that, you know, the real implications of those things. And I think it is important for us to remember that beating up on our industry, you know, kind of is a bipartisan issue these days, sadly. So I think we have to be careful about, you know, the fringes on both parties and just trying to educate the middle on how our sector works and the value behind it.
Yeah, and I would also add just educating even the lawmakers on ensuring that they read fully what the laws that are being passed exactly. You know, yes, if you maybe vote on the headlines or being asked on the very high level question, if you are okay, let's say with IRA on the Medicare pricing, that is one thing. But I think I'm not sure if that many people have truly understood the implications of IRA to our industry overall. And a lot of the positives also, even the way it's drafted, that they were hoping to get out are they're not going to be able to really get that much benefit from the positives. I mean, we've seen the same thing in the passing of the American Innovation Act, where people didn't appreciate that there was an element there where you allowed for IPR reviews, so you allowed anyone to come and strike down your extraordinarily valuable patents. So I think we'll see the same here. And Brad, to your point, it all comes down to education, and it's not really one side or the other. It's a bipartisan need to educate our lawmakers and the others in population and the markets on what biotech companies do.
I'm actually a little less pessimistic, Brad, than you are on the election. I don't want to say optimistic, but you know, I mean, certainly Joe and Donald will have their critiques of pharma, but it's really what happens in the legislature that I think is impactful, and you know, short of sort of a clear blue wave where Biden wins and you see the House and the Senate go to the Democrats, which seems like a very low probability given the seats that are up for grabs, in particular in the Senate. I think you're looking at gridlock, and you know, you're just not going to see any motion. You know, I don't think there's any expectation that the IRA is going to get repealed under any scenario with any government structure. So, you know, I think what's positive for pharma at this point is just if nothing kind of happens and you just see kind of continued or even greater gridlock. So, you know, I think we might hear some noise out of the candidates. I think a lot of the damage to pharma from a government standpoint is kind of done.
All right. Well, we just have a few minutes left, so I'll go around the horn for maybe like closing remarks. And maybe, Brian, I'll start with you. Like, we didn't really get your take earlier on, you know, these IPOs and just like the general enthusiasm for like biotech lately. What's your take on seeing like, you know, yesterday's, you know, 97% increase with in a company that's still in a phase three trial?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's good. It's bad. It's a little bit of both. I mean, certainly people want to get rewarded for taking risks. So, you know, an immediate jump of a couple hundred percent is nice. You know, you can also argue that it's poor price discovery on the part of the market to issue and immediately see a doubling in the stock price. But look, you know, I think the sentiment has kind of turned. A lot of it has sort of had to do with you know, interest rates and monetary and fiscal policy getting a little softer, and I think we all kind of hope for that to continue. But yeah, I mean, we all want to see the markets open back up to some extent. I mean, it's been a very tough 3 years, I think, for all of us that are in the group. So you know, just seeing things go out and not crashing and burning is, you know, really what I think we're all hoping for. And so far, so good.
Tim, any closing thoughts from you?
Yeah, I mean, I'd echo Brian's comments. I mean, right on. So we are in the early stages of a classic recovery. This is a macro-driven downturn that we've seen. And, you know, we haven't had one of those for quite a while in our sector, at least inflation-driven. And it's going to be a while. So, you know, things are kind of hot this month, but this is going to be a halting and gradual recovery. So what we have not seen yet are the entry of generalists and retail in any meaningful way into our sector. And that is going to be changing in the months ahead, and it's going to be good for our sector. So I'm very optimistic about this year and just so relieved that we're finally at this point.
And Luba, I'll leave it to you to close things out.
Sure. Echo everyone's comments. The only thing I would add, we haven't yet seen that enthusiasm trickle down to company formation in the same way that we've seen that before, but especially with additional money and generalists and others coming in, I think hopefully that will change. And then also people again will start looking at true innovation rather than safe me too asset deals.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot, everyone. Daphne, of course, was out this week. I think she'll be back next week. And let's hope we're talking about many of the same things, like, you know, successful IPOs, financings, and data releases. Until then, have a great weekend and go Chiefs. I'm looking forward to that AFC championship game.
Thank you, Brad.
Thanks, all right. Brad.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks, everyone. Have a good weekend.
Bye.